It feels a little lonely up here. The talk this afternoon's on the Four Noble Truths. And as a way to kind of frame that or put it in context, I'm going to tell the story, or a pretty edited version of this story that kind of leads up to that. The Buddha lived in a place where he was like royalty. His father was the king of a small kingdom right at the foothills of the Himalayas. And so he lived that kind of life, like very privileged and protected, a lot of pleasure. And yet, there was something inside of him that was like sensing, wanting to know something different, wanting to know something larger. And again, this is very edited. And so at one point he just, I'm out of here, and like cut off his hair and joined the practices and the people, the ascetics of the time, whereas in that time it was believed that the body was in the way of freeing the mind, like the mind somehow got attached to the body and the body was the problem, and that if you just kind of mortified the body and subdued the body, then it would release the mind. And so he did those practices, you know, very, very intense ascetic practices for 6 years, to the point where he almost died. His health, you know, got so bad, malnutrition and all of it, that he almost died. And kind of when he was on the brink, he kind of thought, well, this isn't working. You know, this is not the way. And so then took some food and got strong enough to practice. And that's when, once he got strong, it's like, okay, well, if that wasn't the way, you know, it was like, what now? Like, where are we? And he had a memory of himself as a young boy, sitting under a rose apple tree, watching his father preside over some a planting ceremony, because agrarian culture. So the king, you know, presiding over these ceremonies. And he just remembered being very at ease, relaxed, very naturally hearing sounds, seeing sights, etc. You see the analogy? And he was like, that was good. That was really good. And then he was like, could that be it? Like, could that be it? And then tuned in, he was like, that is it. That's it. That's the way. He's like, okay, he's got his health back. His compass is directed in the right direction now. And that's when he makes that famous statement, like, basically, I'm going to take this seat under the Bodhi tree and I'm not getting up until I'm enlightened. Let me die right on this cushion. I don't care. I am not getting up till I'm enlightened. And then, of course, Mara hears that and goes, wow, this person's really intent. And Mara attacks the Buddha with desire and aversion, and through the Bodhisattvas, like steadfastness. And he was a really good meditator by this point already, and he was able to stay present and banish Mara. And that's when then he sat through the night. And at each watch of the night, like the first third, the second third, and the third third of the night, he came to realize different things. And on the first watch of the night, he came to realize how it is that we keep on suffering, like this cyclic cycle that just keeps going. And he saw that clearly. He realized it, and he just, yeah, I see it now. And in fact, what we were practicing this morning, the Vedana, the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, that is part of that circle. It's when we're not mindful that things are pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, is when we start to grasp. And that's a big part of how that circle keeps going. So, you know, you're practicing with the exact things that can put an end to this cycle of suffering. So he saw that. And then in the second watch of the night, he became aware and could know all his past lives. And then in the third watch of the night is when he realized the Four Noble Truths. Suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and the path leading to the end of suffering. And once that got perfectly clear in his mind, then, you know, when the morning star was on the horizon and dawn was just happening, that's when his mind fully opened to the deathless. And so I want to talk about these Four Noble Truths, as they are really, you know, all the teachings of the Buddha are in there. Whatever lineage one might practice in, they're all going to be some kind of extension or an expression of those Four Noble Truths, of these Four Noble Truths. First, though, there is a something the Buddha said, a quote, and this isn't going to be exactly, but the meaning is there. And he said, "I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering." And we hear that and go, wait a second, that's two things. What do you mean? So when we don't understand, when we don't kind of see clearly and we hear that statement, we think it's two things. Once we understand, or to the degree that we understand reality, particularly suffering, once to the degree that we understand that is to the degree that we see that is actually one thing. It's not two things. Four Noble Truths. One really helpful way to remember them is suffering and its cause, happiness and its cause. Yeah, just two sets. The Pali word that gets translated to suffering is dukkha. And important to know this word, because we're going to explore it just a little bit, because to understand the Four Noble Truths is really to understand dukkha. And then the second noble truth, the cause of suffering, is craving, tanha in Pali. And when you hear craving or grasping or clinging in Dharma teachings, it doesn't just mean grabbing on and wanting. It does mean that, but it also means pushing away. So it stands for both. So that's the cause of suffering, when we're craving, when we're grasping after, and like we've said much this week, and pushing away, that's going to lead to suffering. It is suffering. Third noble truth in the Pali word is Nibbana. You're probably more familiar with the Sanskrit term Nirvana. Yeah, so it's just different, slightly different languages. And then the Noble Eightfold Path is the fourth noble truth. And I'll spend a little bit of time with that, but much more about dukkha, because again, it's the key. Each noble truth, the Buddha said, there is something that we are to do with that, the way that we're supposed to kind of practice with it. And with the first one, with dukkha, and this is key, is it's to be understood, or sometimes the word that gets used is experienced. That's what we're to do with it, to experience it, to understand it. I'll go into that more. Second one, tanha, is to abandon. Let it go. Don't do it. The third one, nibbana, is to be realized. That's what we want to do. We want to realize freedom from suffering. And the fourth one, the Noble Eightfold Path, what we are to do with it is to cultivate it. So our practice is really just an ongoing cultivation of these eight path factors. So just go into dukkha a bit. It's interesting because dukkha is translated as suffering. Lots of other words that round out this experience, like stress, or even like a word like vulnerability is a word that can be used. Unreliability. What's the other one that I'm wanting to put out? Unsatisfactory. That's an important one to know. Because there is a... Hard not to give too much backstory. Dukkha can be known and experienced in... It's just the way things are and its unsatisfactory nature. It's just... Like, there's actually nothing wrong, even. But we have to know unsatisfactory to what? Yeah, why? And when we say it's just the way things are, it means everything is dukkha. A gust of wind is dukkha. Your next meal is dukkha. Your next vacation is dukkha. Your next stubbed toe is dukkha. It's not just the unpleasant things. Actually, everything is considered unsatisfactory. But unsatisfactory to what is key? And that is unsatisfactory to our, and you've heard us talk about this, our deep built-in desire to be happy. Deep happiness. Deep unchanging happiness. Unconditional happiness. That's not dependent on this or that being a certain way. Because if it's dependent on this or that being a certain way, and we live in a world where things are constantly changing, do you see the miss? It's not going to work. So if we want to be really deeply happy and not have that leave us, we have to find a way to be happy with things that are changing, that aren't reliable, meaning to stay the same way, or to be the way we like them to be, or to not be the way we don't like them to be for any longer than we wish, or any of that. So things are just unsatisfactory in that way. It doesn't mean they're wrong or they're bad. It just means they can't fulfill that need, our deepest want. They just can't do it because they come and they go. It's just simple like that. You can't... you can't paint a wall with a screwdriver. It's not the instrument to do it. It won't work, right? So the things of this world, both physical and mental, they're not the tool, they're not the right thing to give us the deep happiness that we're looking for. And we can come to know that. We can, how do we know that? By paying attention, by just looking. It's not some like super magical thing that we're going to do. It's just by hanging out with our experience, Remember, that doesn't have to be any different than it is at any given moment. But by hanging out with that ever more intimately, then we start to see, yeah, oh, that was pleasant, and here we are. And this holds true for everything. So it's good to see this. We want to see this. It doesn't mean we don't engage with the world. It doesn't mean we don't, whatever, have that yummy meal or be in that lovely relationship or whatever. It doesn't mean we don't do that. What it means is, if we start to see clearly, what it means is we stop demanding that those things give us what we really want. We stop demanding that life do something that it can't do. It's the demanding of life to do something that it can't do is where we get into trouble. So that's just as it is, and there doesn't have to be suffering with it. We can know something as unsatisfactory, not demand that it give us what it can't give us, and be equanimous with that. Like, it's okay. I'll keep going to the meal example. It's okay that that meal doesn't give us what we want. It's kind of a benign example. Relationships are a little harder one. What do you mean? That too? That too. Relationships are dukkha. Like, they're bad? They're suffering? No. This form of dukkha, they're just unsatisfactory. Just that. Nothing more than that. And we can kind of get on board with that. We can start to be congruent with how life is, as opposed to non-congruent and like rubbing against it and battling it. And the battling is, I demand that you give me what I want, even though you can't. You can give me pleasantness, you can give me joy, you can give me loveliness, you can give me all sorts of great stuff, but you can't give me the deep, deep, deep contentment, peace, ease, final resting place that the heart wants. Only I can do that. The things, nothing, no thing can do that. We have to learn how to be in correct relationship with things. Then we can start to be at peace. So no suffering here, right? But then you're like, well, wait a second. The first noble truth is suffering. Dukkha is suffering. Like, what are you saying? When we don't realize this, or to the degree that we don't get that things are unsatisfactory, then we're demanding. Then tanha kicks in. We start craving. And now we're off to the races. And we suffer. Then dukkha is suffering. Yeah? When we don't see dukkha just for what it is, it's just how things are. It's okay. We may not like it at first, but it's just how things are. When we don't see that, then our relationship to it is such that it causes suffering, which is the second noble truth. And there's a teaching that I heard one time that really made this crystal clear. And that is, so we know, okay, if you know the Four Noble Truths, or you just heard them, yeah, the cause of the First Noble Truth is the Second Noble Truth, craving, yeah? Well, the proximate cause for the Second Noble Truth to arise itself, like, well, what's the cause of craving, yeah? Ignorance of dukkha. when we're ignorant, when we ignore dukkha, when we don't understand it, experience it, when we don't become intimate with it, i.e. we ignore it or we're ignorant of it, that is the condition that's supportive for craving to arise. Why? Because we don't see clearly that we're not going to get what we want from the things of the world, so we demand it and craving arises. And so a big part of our practice through being present is to just start to see all of this. Now, I'm saying it, right? It's just didactic. It's kind of like 2D. It's maybe it's impressing on you or maybe it's not, right? But when we are bringing our own attention and our own mindfulness to our life and our experience, then it comes alive. That's where our practice comes alive. It's 3D. It's real. It's our own experience. And we can see it. And I know you've had times on this retreat where that was so. You know, someone saying like, wow, I had pain in my body and it was actually okay. I didn't have to push it away. I could actually just be with it. And in being with it, I saw that's not where the suffering lies. It's not there. It's how I relate to it. But in that instance, one had to be, experience, move close to that difficulty. In that moment, if that person was pushing it away or distracting themselves, then that knowing wouldn't have happened. It came through being present with that. And this is not to say we go digging for suffering or, you know, we must always just be with suffering. It's not to say that, right? I talked about emotions, and like, there are times where we need to take care and distance, etc. In general, though, you know, have you ever heard the expression, the way out is through? Yeah. So that's suffering and craving and their deep, intimate relationship with one another. One is the cause of the other, right? Craving is the cause of suffering, but the ignorance of suffering is what supports the arising of craving. So they're very, very intertwined. When or to the degree that craving stops. I was going to say that we put it down, but it's not actually even that willful. It's not that willful because when suffering is seen clearly, when dukkha is seen clearly, then, or to the degree it's seen clearly, then to the degree the only sane response is to not crave. Like it's just like ripe fruit falling off a tree. It's just what happens. So often, you know, it's interesting, it's like abandon craving. Yes, but it almost sounds a bit too willful. Abandon craving by deeply experiencing and understanding dukkha, then it will let go on its own. And it is possible, I have to divulge, I'm not speaking from experience here, that when craving completely ends and the mind is not, it's not demanding anything on anything anymore. It doesn't need anything to be one way or another, to be completely happy. And then again, it's like not, oh boy, fireworks happy. It's the deep contentment and peace and ease of rest, really, for the heart and mind. Heart and mind is just one word in this teaching in Pali. Chitta is the word. They don't differentiate. It's not differentiated. When that movement of chitta, I'll just keep using that word, slows down, again, stops demanding and, ooh, more. It's like, stops moving and rests back in its own loveliness, actually, then it can merge with a realm, a reality that is the deathless. But it's not like something that's gotten. It's like what's left over when all the movement and all the craving ends. There's just emerging with that. And the word Nibbana, the word that gets translated into the English word enlightenment, the actual meaning of it means to cool down. And it's like the mind, the heart mind, chitta, that is busy demanding things of life, it's agitated, it's hot, you know? Yeah? Like, and they use the example in the teachings of fire. Yeah? It's dancing, it's moving, and it's hot, and it has fuel, right? That fuel is craving. Once we take all the fuel away, the fire dies down and goes out. Actually, all the fuel is completely taken away in the fire and things get completely cool, fire goes out. There's no more agitation, no more heat, just chilled out. You can think of Nibbana as like chilled out to the nth degree. Yeah. And, you know, on one level, it certainly is like a very supra mundane state. Like, that is true. We don't want to like dumb it down. It's significant. And there are ways that we can kind of like get the scent of it, or at least just start to feel like what it feels like for craving to end. And a great place to feel that is when you wake up from being lost in thought. If judgment is suspended. If there's any form of judgment, or that shouldn't have happened, or I'm wrong that it happened, you know what I'm talking about. That's going to cloud that moment. There is a moment of the letting go of whatever that was that we were carried off by, the wanting, the not wanting, the hoping, the past, the future. And then that stops, and there's a moment of like, but often we don't realize it because it gets covered over by reactivity, by like, oh, I'm thinking again, or thinking shouldn't have happened, or whatever. Yeah? So that's and that moment happens a lot, right? That wake-up moment. We get lost a lot, and we wake up a lot. So that's a great place to notice just the ending of craving, the ending of wanting and not wanting. Not the final ending, but a moment of it. And we can, you know, if we kind of prime ourselves to look for and experience it, we can, there's lots of examples of it. Have you ever had like a friendship or a partner where you have this one place where it's just so easy, you both slide into argument and yeah? And then sometimes after a while, it's like, it just gets old, or you get more mindful of it or whatever. And, you know, the conditions are such, here, it's coming. And it's kind of like, no. Right? And you have that moment where you just let that go. And kind of what's left over. It's like, oh, that's nice. Yeah. Yeah, so we can there's all sorts of moments in our lives where we can experience the ending of craving, you know, momentarily. And it's good to experience those. You know, so we can at least see it's possible, and it's quite lovely, and since it's lovely, we might as well be there for it and enjoy it. But in terms of here and on retreat, the wake-up moment is a great place to notice that. And it doesn't mean it's going to be like big fireworks thing, but it can be a nice, cool, like kind of like an out-breath, like, ah. The fourth noble truth, the Noble Eightfold Path, are these eight different path factors. And they're grouped into three sections. The ethical conduct section, it's called Sila in Pali. And then the kind of the mind training, heart and mind training section. It's the word gets samadhi gets used for that, for the collecting the mind, and then the wisdom section. There's two path factors of wisdom. That's called panya. So sila, samadhi, panya, and there's like this progression as we bring our attention to our how we speak and act, kind of how we move through this world, and we work with doing that in a way that's non-harming, more and more non-harming and kind and compassionate. As we are able to do that, then when we turn towards training the heart and mind to settle and gather, it's easier to do because there's less reverberations. If we're going through life like a bull in a china shop, causing a lot of difficulty and suffering for ourselves and others, the chitta it reverberates, right? We have remorse, we're thinking about the past, why did I say that? Oh no, they're upset with me, or it's just very not settled, yeah? We can all know that from our experience. So as we refine our speech and actions so that they're more non-harming, those reverberations of the heart and mind settle a bit, and that supports then the samadhi part, the collecting of the attention, because we're not fighting all that. You know, it's hard enough. We're not fighting the remorse. And then as we're able to collect the mind a bit and be able to be intimate with our experience and be there with it, then we start to see. So the way Jane Goodall learned about the chimps, right? Amazing. She learned so much about them. How'd she do it? She plunked herself down on the ground and watched. Oh, when they do that, then that happens. Oh, that one. She just watched and watched and watched and watched and watched. And then she gained all this wisdom about chimps. So as we can be more and more present in the moment and be with experience, we start to understand it. And wisdom arises. Wisdom, just clear seeing. Like, oh, it's like that. That's all wisdom is oh, it's like that. Or, oh, it's like this. Oh. As we start to see, oh, it's like this, the need or the desire for or the importance of being kind in this world deepens. And we're even more committed to non-harming. So it loops back. The non-harming now increases even more, which supports the samadhi even more, which develops more wisdom, and it keeps circling and spiraling up that way. For those of you who may know the noble truths and how they're laid out, it doesn't, it's actually not in that order, though. It's not the ethical conduct first. What comes first in the order of the Eightfold Path are the two wisdom factors. It's like, well, wait a second, you just said it was that order. Why is it wisdom and then ethical conduct and then samadhi? Why is it that way? Because in order to even enter the path, in order to just think that spending 7 days without talking and not having the food I like, etc., that might be a good idea, there's some nascent form of wisdom there. Something knows, something slightly knows that this is a good thing. And so the path actually starts with a very nascent form of wisdom. To enter the path at all, there has to be something that draws us there, and that's a very slight or nascent form of wisdom. And as I mentioned, it's not like just a one-shot thing. It keeps looping back on itself and deepening. And so, you know, what we're supposed to do with the Eightfold Path is to cultivate it. Not by tomorrow, not by some time that you think it should be done by, but just staying engaged, keeping practicing as best we can, and cultivating these path factors. You know, each one of these truths of the Four Noble Truths, there could be a five-hour talk on and still not get to the bottom of it. So this was just kind of like an overview. But I think maybe the main piece or one of the important pieces to maybe even, you know, intellectually connect with is the importance of being present, being willing to be present with it, with what is, and being courageous enough actually to take a look at life for just how it is, not how we hope it to be or want it to be or think it should be, but actually how it is. I think that takes courage. And when we do that, then we start to see how things are. Once we see things, as we start to see things how they are, then we don't ask them to be differently. We don't ask things to give us what we want that can't do it. Slowly. I still ask life to give me what I want. I still fall into that. But, you know, slowly we start to see that. Slowly we see more and more. It doesn't work. And far from being a bummer when we see it doesn't work, it's actually liberating. It's like, oh, you know, I can put that addiction down. Maybe even if it's just for this moment. I can put down the burden of being saddled with that compulsion to demand that life be a certain way. Seeing it for how it actually is, which it's fine. It's not like we're going to see this terrible thing. It's just, oh, it's just not going to do it. Okay, good to know. Ah, okay. Now I can move forward with that understanding. Okay, so let's take our quiet time together and let the words settle. I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. Our path is to realize that they are not two things. No bell, so bong. Good to be with you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.